It started around 16. I witnessed my best friend get shot and killed in front of me. And from that point on, like, my life went on a total spiral downhill. Her sister and I had a gang involvement, and she was an innocent bystander. And after trying to commit suicide 3 times, I went to therapy. That didn't work, and just went to drugs and cutting. Well, there's a lot of reasons why I started to cut. It's childhood experiences and shooting. I held on to things. I bottled stuff inside, and I just felt so ashamed of myself. I felt like it was all my fault that my best friend got shot and killed in front of me. And the cutting just, it made me feel better. I guess when I would cut, I felt a sense of relief. Like, when I saw the blood coming out of my arm, I felt like my anger and frustration was being let loose by my blood coming from my arm. It sounds weird, but when I'd cut, it just, it made everything better, and I felt pain on the outside made everything better on the inside, because the pain on the inside was really bad, like, super bad. I heard all about it in high school, and I saw friends who did it, and I'd see marks on their arms, and I used to think they were weird. But after being put through what I was put through, I resorted to cutting just to feel liberated, sense of, because I felt like I was in prison in my own body, and when I just cut my flesh, I felt like I was just getting out just a little bit. And the bondage that came with all the pain and guilt and the shame, that I just felt better every time I cut.
Welcome to Unhooked. My name is Pastor Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Kitty, and today we're going to be talking about self-mutilation.
Hey, it's wonderful to have Robin Butler here with us, and so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for coming. And can you tell us, what are some of the most common types of self-mutilation or self-injurious behaviors?
What we see most often is using sharp objects, cutting on mostly the extremities because they're easier access, arms, hands, legs, abdomen, thighs. A lot of, it's mostly females. We do see it in males too, but mostly females. And a lot of times they'll do it in places where they can hide it, you know, wear long sleeves, pants over it. Sometimes it's cigarette burns. Sometimes they may use tweezers or other sharp objects, and sometimes razor blades, things like that.
Are there triggers? Is there something that's sort of triggering this behavior and this activity?
It's usually intense stress. It could be for, especially women, it can be relationship failures, a boyfriend, you know, losing a relationship or feelings of rejection. It's mostly about loss. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it could be the death of somebody that they were close to, feelings of guilt and shame, to the point where it becomes so overwhelming that the pain, the physical pain that the self-mutilation causes is actually less painful than the emotional pain. And there's also an endorphin release that happens when you have that kind of pain. The body tries to protect itself from feeling when you have an injury, and that's where it kind of gets into an addictive thing after a while.
And, you know, some people do talk about it as, I have, you know, I had all this stuff going on for me, and so it actually felt good to be doing that, and what, like you're describing. When does that become a problem for someone?
Obviously, to have to continue to do that, and like with most addictions, the chemical release that you get when you do that lessens over time, and so you have to do it more and more to get that same effect. And to have to keep injuring yourself in more and more severe ways. We have had patients that have cut so deep that they have cut tendons and gotten to vessels where they accidentally are hitting veins and vessels that they're bleeding.
Wow.
Too much. Sometimes even we had one that hit an abdominal vessel where it almost died. Not to mention just the lasting scars and that it causes.
Yeah. How do you distinguish between someone that's doing self-mutilation versus someone who may be actually attempting suicide? Is there a way to kind of tell the difference?
Well, the best way is to ask them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what is really significant when you are dealing with people that do this, is you really need to ask them what it does for them, because it is a complex thing, and for different people it serves different purposes. For some people, it's a form of self-punishment, mm-hmm. because they have a lot of self-loathing, and this is the way they punish themselves, and it's kind of freeing for them once they've done that. They've paid their penance for whatever real or imagined behaviors that they've done. For some people, it is pain relief. It actually makes them feel better for a while. For some, it helps them feel grounded, because they may have an illness where they don't feel real. They feel like they're kind of floating away, and they don't feel in touch with reality. And this kind of shocks them back to reality. Mm-hmm. And it's a real scary feeling not to feel like you're grounded. So they'll do it for that reason. And so I think it's really important to find out what it specifically does so that you can try and help them get there in another way.
You know, it sounds like what you're talking about really is an addiction issue. And yet, you know, we talk about, well, you know, if it's a drug or something else, that could be harmful in other ways. But is this really an addiction? And Araceli's story that she talks about, she discusses, you know, having to deal with several different addictions, but underlying that was the, you know, the cutting, and that was dealt with later. But it sounds like we really need to take this more seriously as an addictive issue.
Oh, I think so, because this is one addiction where you'll never get rid of the evidence of it. I mean, you can take drugs, and oftentimes once you get off the drug, you can restore the body back to normal, but this is going to be there forever as a reminder. And again, it's something that does go unnoticed, and people don't realize that it is an addiction.
I think Araceli in our story was 16 years old when she started cutting. Is there an age at which we're seeing this happen? You've seen it really young, or is it late in the teens? Or?
You know, it's happening more and more frequently, and it used to be usually just in patients or people that had very severe mental illness. And now it's become almost kind of a cultish thing in adolescents, you know. And with adolescents, you know, once one of them or two of them start doing it and they hear about it, and then pretty soon they're all trying it and becomes kind of in vogue, almost like the vampire thing, you know, it's kind of cool. Everybody, oh, you're cutting, oh, look what I did. Mm. And they start comparing. And so I think it's something that we need to probably, I would say, you know, a pediatrician should look at every patient that comes in for an annual physical to say, you know, do a body check and make sure that they're not doing that. Or every parent, just because it is getting to be more and more prevalent these days.
Well, it sounds like we need to look at this more seriously as an issue in particularly our youth and as an addictive process. It sounds like they also might need to go to treatment for this.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Great. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a little bit.
I would cut almost on a daily basis around the age between 16 and I would say 17. Normally I hear about people cutting with razors and stuff, but I choose to do it with dull objects because it's more painful instead of just using a razor, it, like nail clippers and tweezers, because I'd like pull and it was harder to cut and it made it more painful instead of just a straight cut. It's my left arm that I usually cut on. I had a couple up here, but they've faded. And right here, there's the lighter ones are the old ones and the darker ones are kind of recent. And the recent ones that happened in November was because I had my second abortion, which I felt like I didn't want to do it, but to save my relationship with my father, my son's father, I decided to do what he wanted. And after doing the at-home abortion, I kind of went crazy with the postpartum and all that, and I cut. Even when I was pregnant, I cut. My ex would fight with me a lot about being pregnant and how I was ruining his life, and I remember him dropping me off, and we got into a huge argument because his mom found out that I was pregnant, and she was going to throw him out, and I ran inside crying. My mom was at work, and just the urge to cut came up. I hadn't cut in at least 3 months, and I just went to my room and grabbed tweezers. I found some tweezers and just started pinching my skin until it started bleeding, and then grabbed nail clippers and started clipping, and it's just really bad. It was a way of relieving everything I've messed up on, the shooting and relationships with my children's fathers, just messing up, and I just felt less shameful and guilty. Like, and I still hadn't found God then. My mom, she's always been like, she converted to be a Christian. She had her faith, but I didn't have mine. I was totally, didn't want God in my life. I felt like he put me through a lot of stuff, and I just didn't want to be that way yet.
Welcome back to Unhooked. So, Robin, can you talk to us a little bit about the role that families play in helping someone who's caught up in self-mutilation through the process of recovery?
Well, I think the first step would be to recognize that there's a problem. And I think with any addictive disorder, especially with a child, and especially maybe in a family where either the parents are really, really busy, maybe absent, or maybe in the quote-unquote looking good family, where we don't see this, we don't do this, and so we're going to kind of just like pretend it's not happening. Mm-hmm. Because if we know that it's happening, we're going to have to do something we don't know what to do. You know, it's not that the parents intentionally don't want to help their children, but it just kind of freaks them out. What do you do with something like this? And so I think there's a tendency even subconsciously just not to go there. Mm-hmm. Don't ask, don't tell. Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, it's really getting to know your kids and paying attention to what's going on, paying attention to cues. You know, if they're wearing long sleeves all the time, they're wearing long pants all the time in the summer, and, you know, appear to be hiding something. And with adolescents, it's difficult because they're very secretive anyway. But, mm-hmm. I mean, doing the appropriate things to find out what's going on. Once you find out, sitting down and talking about it, and just asking, what are you doing, and why? What is this doing for you? Why do you feel the need to do that? And how can we help you? What is it that you're needing? What's going on? And asking them what would help, especially with adolescents. Yeah. Because mm-hmm. telling them doesn't tend to work, even if it's a good thing to do.
Involve them in the process.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. How can we help you? I think, you know, when they've gotten to that point, usually some kind of therapy. But like with any addictions, 12-step, it's a spiritual thing. It comes down to a spiritual thing. And different people will need different help. Sometimes there's some genetic, biological things that's driving this. They're hypersensitive to stress, to rejection. and they can't handle what other people may kind of blow off or whatever and adapt. And so it usually takes a multidisciplinary approach. And sometimes seeing somebody that maybe can give them some medication, give them some psychotherapy, some spiritual interventions, work with the family. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes a child is just represents the family dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones acting out. Mm-hmm. But really the whole dynamic is kind of... And that's oftentimes why people don't want to bring it forward, because then it kind
of
upsets the whole family.
Yeah.
And if families realize that, you know, no family is totally functional. There is no Ozzy and Harriet family.
Hmm.
There is no Leave It to Beaver family.
That they don't
is
exist,
a fantasy. Yeah. And so bringing it out into the open, into the light where it can be healed, instead of keeping it in the darkness. Because that's where the devil does his best work, is in the darkness.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, even though... it looks good on the outside.
Well, and this might be, being that it really is about what might be happening in the... Often children do portray what's going on in the family. It might be a little bit scary for a parent or a caregiver to approach the child because of what the response might be and how that might feel for them.
Mm-hmm. And just to know that there is help out there. There are people like ourselves that we're there to help. We know this goes on. We're not going to be shocked. We're not going to be shaming. We understand that it goes on, and we actually are encouraged when parents come in and say, hey, I need help from my child, because that means they're on board. Because we can't really help their kids when they're not on board.
We've been talking a lot about young people and cutting behaviors, but it seems to me I'm hearing more and more about adults, even parents who model this behavior to their children. What do we know about the adult population and how prevalent this is?
Well, for kids that never did get help, they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes they grow up and they continue these behaviors, mm-hmm. just like other addictions, and continue to kind of keep it under wraps, and then they have children and they're still doing this. And they, as they get older, they tend even more not to get help. Until it becomes more and more serious, and oftentimes it's accompanied by other kinds of addictions. And again, sometimes those other addictions may come to light because there's other consequences, legal consequences or physical consequences, and this gets ignored. But I think we have to remember that when we treat one addiction or they stop one addictive behavior, sometimes the other addictive behaviors become much more prominent. And so with the cutting, because it can be very, very dangerous, that has to be addressed too as part of the whole treatment program.
Yeah. How do we help people understand how important it is to take care of our physical bodies and, you know, to be healthy, to take care of this body that we've got?
Yeah, besides... You know, it's the only one we have.
The only one we have.
I think from a spiritual dimension, you know, it's the temple. It's our temple. And that God works through our bodies, our temples, both to communicate with us and to commune with us, and also to use us to communicate with other people and to serve other people. And if we destroy that temple, then we're destroying our capacity to not only commune with him, but to be used by him to help other people. And that's, you know, the way we feel that's our reason for being here.
Right, and we've been talking in some of our other periods of this program about the importance of self-worth and how, you know, God has made us as specifically designed, and, you know, just... relating that to the cutting and the issues you raised about how you feel about yourself and harming yourself.
And ironically, feeling that connection with God and feeling like you are a vehicle by which he can heal and commune with other people oftentimes heals those wounds that drive people to practice those addictive behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Robin. You've been terrific.
Thank you.
And Unhooked will be back.
I'm not proud of what I did. Being 22 years old and everything I've been put through, and the scars are still there, and it's a constant reminder of the past and brings up a lot of old things, but I just didn't know how to cope with pain. That was my way of coping, and I tried to stop a lot of times, and I never found a way to until I found God. He's my rock, He's my everything. Like, when I have that urge, I just repeat scriptures, and it helps me fight it, because I do battle with it still. Before I came to the Lord, when people would tell me, pray or read your Bible, when I was going through troubling times, I'd be like, what's that gonna do? But it does a lot for me, especially when I find scriptures that actually relate to me. Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And I'm gonna be baptized just because I wanna show everybody what God means to me, that I'm willing, I want this, and I'm a Christian now, I'm different. Like, I don't need drugs, or I don't need to cut myself anymore to make myself feel better, because I have God who makes me feel better and who's forgiven me for everything I've done in the past. The world might judge me for what I've done in my past, but God doesn't. He's washed me with Jesus' blood, and I'm cleansed of all my sins. And because of that, I love God, because He loves me. My name is Araceli, and I'm unhooked.
Araceli was hurting so much that she felt that she could only find relief by cutting on herself. My name is Dr. Dave, and I've worked with many women such as Araceli. They find that their pain is just so deep, and somehow they find relief by using razor blades or other sharp instruments to dig into their own flesh. Their self-hatred goes so deeply because they find the false belief that they're responsible for what happened to them. They need to learn how to forgive the people who hurt them. And forgiveness is not something that is easy. Peter once asked Jesus in Matthew 18, how often should I forgive my brother who hurt me? Jesus said, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. And what Jesus was saying is that forgiveness is a process that takes time. As often as you need to, that's how often you need to forgive. How many times have I sinned? How many times has Jesus needed to forgive me? And so forgiveness, even though it is a decision, is also a process. It's a process that requires that we first embrace the pain, that we look at it and own it as our own, and that we seek the comfort of God in the midst of this pain. And I would suggest to you that it's only after we've been comforted that we can truly decide to surrender the other person and no longer require or demand that they repay that which they do owe us. Yes, people who hurt you owe you, but should you demand that when in reality you're not going to get satisfaction from them, even if they tell you that they're sorry? At some point, we come to that place of making a decision to forgive. It's an important decision that we make, but that's not even the end of the process, because sometimes we need to set boundaries with unsafe people. Sometimes we need to create a safe places so we can continue to heal. This is extremely important, and Jesus is the truly only safe place. For more information, to learn about forgiveness and breaking away from habits that hurt, contact Adventist Recovery Ministries. And for prayer, call 1-888-446-7388. Choose to become unhooked today.